This is On Target with Penny Wolfgang, a program that takes an inside look at what is happening in Western New York with news, features, and special guests. Now, here's your host, Penny Wolfgang.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to On Target with your host, Penny Wolfgang. We're here every week, and it's my pleasure to talk to you and to introduce you to guests who may be interesting and hopefully educational, and people who are making a difference to us here in Western New York, making a difference in our lives either educationally or culturally or just by being part of our Western New York community. And today, talking to me via the magic of telephone is Shane Stevenson. And I want to tell you just a little bit about Mr. Stevenson. He is the director of museum collections at the Buffalo Naval Park. And he is sort of in the archive business. I don't know if I'm correctly phrasing that, but we'll ask him. And as among the other books that he has written, among the many books that he has written and subjects that he has studied, one is came to my attention recently. It's about the Larkin Company, which, as you may or may not know, is one of the most innovative and important companies here in Western New York, and was, and the whole area has been named after Mr. Larkin and the Larkin Company down near downtown. And he also wrote a very interesting book about Buffalo's East Side industry, and probably others too. So welcome, Mr. Stevenson. Welcome, Shane, since we've spoken to each other quite a while. I guess I'll call you Shane, right?
Yes. Is that thank you, and hello from the USS Little Rock, where my office is here at the
Oh, is that right? Well, first, let me just ask you about your interest in the Little Rock and in the museum and the Naval Park itself, because that is so, so instrumental. It has been in building up our whole waterfront and our tourist industry even. It's just been phenomenal. So tell us a little bit about that, could you?
Yes, sure. It'd be my pleasure. So the Buffalo Naval Park was kind of the first tenant of the re-envisioned waterfront here in Canal Side, right? We opened in 1979 here in Buffalo, and we got our two vessels originally, USS the Sullivans and USS Little Rock in 1977, and again we opened for visitors in 1979. So yes, we have been kind of the first anchor tenant here at Canal Side. And then in 1988, we got the submarine USS Croker, and we've been moving forward ever since.
Tell us about the museum collection that you are the director of. What does that mean? Are you responsible for getting the different artifacts that are in the museum and the museum itself?
Absolutely. So my job is to catalog and archive and preserve and make accessible the artifacts that have been donated to us over the past 42 years. So we have not had a person in my position for about 22 of those years, and so there's a lot that has been donated that just hasn't been properly archived or processed. So I'm gathering together all of our photographs and all of our collections that people donate, whether they're diaries or their own photographs, you know, information about their service during the military. Uniforms, you know, certainly the largest largest artifacts are our three ships. So it's also my job to make sure that we're preserving the ships in an appropriate way to keep them enjoyed for many years into the future.
Some people may not be familiar with the ships, although I can't imagine how, since they've been there, they've been such an attraction and so much has centered around them. But maybe we'll just take a chance and tell our listeners what the ships are and a little bit about them.
Sure. Yes, I'd be happy to. So we actually have four vessels, but one of them is on land and not in the water. That's our PTF boat. So when people walk by our ships, if they look away from the water, they'll see the large green wooden vessel. And that was what was called a fast patrol boat, and that was used during the Vietnam conflict. And then she served in the Blue Water Fleet here in the Great Lakes in Chicago as a security boat. monitoring the shorelines of the Great Lakes. We also have, obviously, our three largest vessels are the USS Croker, as I mentioned, and interestingly enough, tomorrow is USS Croker's birthday, which means that that's when she was launched and her sponsor smashed the champagne bottle across her bow and she went down the ways. So we're looking forward to celebrating her 77th birthday tomorrow. She did serve in World War II in the Pacific, and the USS Croker sank 11 Japanese vessels during the year and a half that she was in World War II service.
What? Wow.
She served in the U.S. Navy in varying roles until about 1968, and she was fully decommissioned out of the Navy in 1971. For our medium-sized ship, if you want to call her that, is our Fletcher-class destroyer, USS the Sullivans. All right, so she was named after the five brothers, the five Sullivan brothers from Waterloo, Iowa, that had all perished on the same ship. So she is a ship of sacrifice, and we tell the story of the five brothers and that no family in American history has sacrificed as much as the Sullivan family has, losing all five of her sons on the same ship on the same night.
And tell me if I'm right that because of the Sullivans, they made a law, the government has passed a law that that could not never happen again?
Well, there is the there was already laws in place preventing families from serving together. So the Navy, two of the brothers had already served in the Navy prior to all five of them enlisting, and they were honorably discharged, and they served in the early 1941. And when they all signed up together, they really very quickly made national news of here's five Sullivan, you know, here's the five brothers from Waterloo. And so they were already gaining recognition even before their enlistment and during their enlistment. So I think there was some pressure on the Navy to allow them to serve because the brothers, that was their demand. They said, we are serving together or not at all. So I think the Navy bent the rule that was in place. And, of course, a terrible tragedy happens in November of 1942, and all five brothers lost their lives. So there already was rules and regulations in place, but the Navy, because of the recognition, national recognition that the family was receiving, bent the rule.
That's a terrible story, but yet very heroic, inspiring.
Yes, it is inspiring, and there is a USS the Sullivans in service today that was sponsored by the granddaughter of one of the five brothers, a woman by the name of Kelly Sullivan, who is living in Waterloo or Cedar Rapids, maybe, Iowa, and she is the only progeny of the five brothers, you know, being passed down from her father, and she does have a brother as well, but so all five brothers, she has a very interesting stories to tell. She comes into Buffalo about once a year, once every year and a half. And, you know, she has very interesting stories to tell about family sacrifice. But she would be the first to say that it's not only her family, it's all families sacrifice something when they have a serviceman or servicewoman in a branch of the military.
Absolutely. And if any, so, yes. And anybody who is listening to this show today on Target, we thank you for your service, and we thank you for listening.
Yes.
So now we come to the third ship.
Yes.
Fourth, actually.
The USS Little Rock, all right? So she was constructed. She was originally, in her original configuration, was a Cleveland-class cruiser, and she was constructed for World War II, but by the time she was commissioned, you know, the U.S. Navy didn't need more ships in the Pacific. You know, the Axis forces were beginning to recoil and retreat, and so she became a peacetime vessel and was and served most of her career as the flagship of the Sixth Fleet, which is the Mediterranean Fleet. So while the USS the Sullivans saw action at Okinawa and Iwo Jima and the Philippines, and same with our USS Croker. The USS Little Rock never served in combat during conflict.
And these are all, not only do we have them and own them and have them on display, but during the season, which is, I guess, not the winter, people can actually go. I know I've been on the Little Rock, so they can go on the ship and see a lot of the how they operate. And it's fascinating to anyone who is not familiar, as most people I think are not, with the inner workings of the ships.
Yes. Yeah, you're absolutely right, Judge. It's just the engineering that went in to keep these ships, to build these ships and to keep these ships afloat, and to think that there were, you know, hundreds of these ships built during the World War II conflict is just an astounding feat, and it talks about the U.S. workforce and U.S. Labor that they were. I mean, for USS the Sullivans, there was 175 of those ships constructed all over the country in a very short amount of time, 2-3 years.
You know, people are comparing the effort that was made during the war that you just described to what is happening now during the pandemic and say with the vaccine, and say there has never been, you know, an effort like that since the World War II for everyone to work together and to quickly make something that's so important to our lives. And there was the same, yeah.
It's amazing. You know, there are different threats, but yeah, to mobilize the U.S. workforce, to mobilize transportation and logistical, you know, issues as a country is something that we're working on, as you said, right now.
Oh, I wanted to switch to a topic. Oh, first of all, I want to tell our listeners you're listening to On Target with your host, Penny Wolfgang, and we are talking to Shane Stevenson. And Mr. Stevenson is an archivist, a director of the museum collection at the Buffalo Naval Park, and an author. And I think the point of being an author, as far as I can tell, is that you are studying, really, all your books have to do with the different histories of different aspects or geographical areas or companies here in Western New York. Am I right?
You are absolutely correct, yes. For the two books that I've written in their historical picture books, with, you know, detailed captioning and, you know, an introduction and things like, you know, those aspects of the book. I really focused on industry. That's a passion of mine. And so with Buffalo's East Side Industry and with the Larkin Company, they focus more on the aspects of what the companies did, more so. And especially with the Larkin Company book, I don't really focus on the family as much, the Larkin family. But, you know, I focus on, you know, his passion and how he channeled that through the workplace.
Well, there might be people who aren't familiar with the history of the Larkin Company or the people that you're talking about. So I need you to help us out here.
Sure. Yeah, so the Larkin Company was, their catalog was, you know, second in size only to the Sears Roebuck company out of Chicago, right? So they started off as a traditional soap manufacturing company, and their first product was laundry soap called Sweet Home, right? So they started making laundry soap, so kind of in in the First Ward area on Chicago Street. And he had already had about 10 years of experience working in the soap manufacturing business, John Larkin did. And he was in Chicago, and he eventually moved back in 1874, 1875, and he founded his company here in 1875. So they were very traditional in the way they sold. One of the wonderful aspects of John Larkin was that he was able to bring disparate and various minds together and work towards a common problem. And, one of the first people he worked with was Elbert Hubbard. And, you know, he certainly is now known as the sage of East Aurora and the Roycroft movement. But he met Albert because John married Albert's sister, right? So he married into the Hubbard family, and he brought Albert Hubbard along with him, coming back to Buffalo. And he was really, those two really started the Larkin idea, you know, getting rid of, you know, the salesman and going directly to the family, going directly to the household to sell their product. So they did that in a variety of different ways. They had a what they called a combination box, which would have about 142 different products in it, and families would buy those, and then they would have all of that product, whether it be, you know, toilet soaps, you know, what today we would call bath soap, and laundry soap. And so the germ of the Larkin idea, which really kind of propelled them to great heights, was the use of the Larkin secretary. So the Larkin secretary wasn't an actual employee of the Larkin company, but they set up early clubs, you know, or clubs early on in America, where there would be women in neighborhoods, there would be a secretary who would be the leader of these clubs, and they would share product from the catalog, and that's how they really spread the Larkin message, was through these clubs. So women in a neighborhood would set up a club of 5 women, of 10 women, of 16 women, and then they would all go through that month's catalog. They would order what they need, and then if the order came to more than $10 or more than $20, they would also receive a free premium product, which would have been something for the household, whether it was a rug or a lamp or, you know, some paint, dishes, silverware. And so they would receive a product for free, which would then be given in rotation throughout the club itself. So that was really the germ of the idea, going directly to the housewife in the home, having her establish clubs for women in her neighborhood, and then they would receive the products and also a free premium out of the catalog of Larkin products.
This sounds like a soap opera. Get it? Okay, I just had to throw that in. Hey, listen, this was probably the beginning of other people followed in this, like you hear, I don't know, Avon or one of the other things that people...
Tupperware,
yeah, I was thinking about that. It all followed this this initial program that they came up with.
Yes, it was very revolutionary in its day. And yes, other companies have modeled it. As you said, Avon, certainly Tupperware. Everyone remembers Tupperware parties, you know, from the 60s and 70s and 80s. But it also created the seed of the company's downfall as well, which is also covered in the book. Because times changed, you know, around 1915 to 1920, and where companies like Sears and Roebuck addressed that and understood that change, Larkin was just too slow to recognize that change. And it really, the change came from growing technology of the automobile. So where Sears and Roebuck said, oh, we should start developing actual brick-and-mortar stores to address the growth of the automobile, and people would be able to just drive to a store instead of ordering it out of a catalog and having to wait a week or 2 weeks. The movement of women's, you know, equal rights for women, right? Getting the right to vote during World War I, women were going into the workplace. And so they began seeing themselves, women did, as more than just housewives ordering out of a catalog. And so these clubs that they had set up around the country, and around 1920 at its height, there were about 90,000 clubs around the country in all the states. Women stopped, you know, holding the clubs because they said to themselves, we're more than just ordering, you know, product for our husbands and our children, and they wanted to work. They had just been given the right to vote, and so they began. Women began to view themselves in a different way, and so they stopped managing and organizing these clubs. So what really propelled the company to great heights with this innovative idea of going right to the woman in the household, that also, when women started to view their changing roles, that also took the clubs away, that also then took the profit away, and the company began downsizing after 1920, 1921.
Were they manufacturing, Larkin, were they manufacturing the soap and products here in Western New York, here in Buffalo?
Yes, many, yes.
I mean,
that's a great question, yes. Yes, they certainly were. And so that's the Larkinville area now, with 701 Seneca, the Larkin Exchange building. The 701 Seneca was really their factory. Certainly across the street, there was the famous Larkin Administration Building. So the office staff worked in the Larkin Administration Building, while the factory was in the large 701 Seneca building. And a lot of the logistical transportation for all of the product took place in the Larkin Exchange Building, the narrow building, also there right next to 701 Seneca.
So now everything has turned around and come back. What goes around comes around. Now everyone is ordering. Nobody is going to the brick and mortar, or very few. Everyone is now back in their homes ordering everything online, which is a version of what the Larkin company started out with, as you were describing. And everyone is doing it, not just housewives, as we call them, but women at home, but men and everybody else.
Judge, it's amazing, isn't it? It's amazing
yes.
how it has swung back. And all of those logistical problems that they had back then, we certainly see now. Everyone who's ordering online says, oh, your delivery might be delayed because of logistics, right? And so the Larkin Company always had logistical problems around Christmas time, which is when you usually always want your product. Because back then it was railroads. Gave first rights to coal companies, especially in the Northeast and around the Great Lakes. So they would always transport coal first before any other ancillary product, or, you know, say from the Larkin Company or the hundreds of other companies that were shipping. So we see that kind of logistical problem today. The infrastructure might not be as strong as it needs to be. And, so the problems back 100 years ago are still problems today.
I think it's so amazing. As you were talking about, I was thinking to myself, I was saying, oh, people want to go and order and go into the stores, and people wanted to get out of their homes and they wanted to go to the brick and mortar stores like Sears and whatever. Now I'm thinking to myself, this could be today where just the opposite, you know, they should start the company again. Too bad they can't start.
Wouldn't that be fabulous?
Were they called Larkin? If you look in history, was it called Larkin Soap, or did it have other names?
Well, they did have plenty of names, and they even had plenty of names. It was the John Larkin Soap Manufactory. It was the Larkin Company. So they themselves, as they grew, changed their own name of the company itself. But they always had different products with different names. Sweet Home Soap, Majesta, so they used various names for all of their products. So their main line was home products for cleaning, whether it's yourself, bathing products, toothpaste, their household cleaners. But then they also had that arm of what they would call premiums, which were more like household goods, as I had mentioned, couches, furniture, rugs, paint, silverware, dishes. And they also seeded many companies that were around Buffalo. Probably the most famous was the Buffalo Pottery Company. Then they seeded that company so they wouldn't have to make the product themselves on Seneca Street. They would work with other companies, seed them, give them some startup money, and then they would be the main customer for those companies like Buffalo Pottery. The F.N. Burt Company is another one, which produced boxes. And so they would create other companies within the Buffalo area.
Sort of spin-off companies.
Yes.
Like spin-off. But it had to be so important. It was had to be crucial to the economy in those days. It had to be like when they talk about what's the number one for the economy here, employer, it had to be the Larkin Company. It had to be way up there. If not
yes,
the.
Yes. They were really, to my understanding, they were really the first large company here in Buffalo. They had about 2,500 people in Buffalo working, many of them young girls, before they got married. There were other large companies, obviously, in my other book, The Buffalo Z-Side Industry, I cover... You know, the Buffalo Forge Company, Buffalo Foundry and Machine, and certainly Worthington, like those huge, large companies, they were a little, because of the product they made, they didn't grow right around the same time as Larkin. So Larkin at the time, you know, we're looking at 1900, 1905, they were already at, you know, 2,500 workers around 1907. Which was probably the largest at the time, certainly.
Shane, we actually ran out of time, and I wanted to talk to you about, you just mentioned the other book also, so we're going to have you come back another time and talk about the East Side Industry. But meanwhile, let our listeners know how they could reach you, how they can find your books, where they can buy them or get them online, or what should they do if they want more information, which I bet they do after hearing this fascinating discussion.
Well, thank you. Yes, thank you, Judge. Certainly, speaking of mail order businesses, they are certainly online at Amazon and Barnes & Noble. They also at Talking Leaves, you know, another local bookshop. I can be reached through an email, which is arcinthebuff@yahoo.com. So that's arcinthebuff@yahoo.com. So arcinthebuff@yahoo.com. And that's how someone could reach me directly. You know, certainly I was out signing a lot of books and selling a lot of books at the Broadway Market and other local author days and things, but we haven't done any of that this year. But I can certainly sign a book. If you want to get in touch with me, I can sign it for as a gift for someone. So, there's plenty of avenues to get it. And then you can reach me at arcinthebuff, arcinthebuff, at Yahoo. And I can sign them for you.
Thank you so much. It was wonderful talking to you.
Thank you, Judge.
Really appreciated it. And like I said, we're going to get back to you again sometime in the near future, and we can talk a little about the West Side East Side Industries, rather, because I think that would be so interesting for our listeners. So thank you so much, everybody, and thank you, Shane Stevenson, and our dear listeners. Have a good week. Thank you for listening, and we'll be with you again next week, same time, same station, for On Target. Goodbye, everybody.
You've been listening to On Target with Penny Wolfgang, a program that takes an inside look at Western New York and our community. If you have any comments or suggestions, please write to Penny Wolfgang at 500 Corporate Parkway, Suite 200, Amherst, New York, 14226.